Have we survived Christmas? Largely? Yeah? Some nods. How about New Year's? Yeah? All ready to go? Let's see over the next 4 weeks how ready we are. It'd be nice, it'd be good. So what I'm trying to do here, give me a minute, what I'm trying to do is play you some really old music, okay? If you see kind of objectionable things on YouTube, that's not my fault. I'm just going to kind of bypass that. How many of you know about calypso? Does the term calypso mean anything to you? You don't count, Jill. I know you know. One. Any more calypso cognoscent is two. Three. Okay, tell me what calypso is, one of you. Go on, tell me what calypso is. Who said he or she knew what calypso was? You did, didn't you? Sorry? Yeah, what kind? Caribbean, very good. Any favorite calypsos? Okay, let's see if you like this. I hope there's a snippet of this. Listen to the words. I'm going to ask you about the words in a bit.
To live in London, you rarely come back. Because the English people are very much social. They let you hear and they make you feel like they let you be like you are in the air. So London, that's the place for me. Yes, I never complain of the time I spent. I mean, my life in London is really magnificent. I have every comfort that there is for, and my residence is a London for. So London, that's the way for me.
Okay, we'll stop there. That's a kind of happy new year to you. Okay, what stood out for you? What did you notice? Any particular lyric stood out? Yeah, why did that stand out for you? Okay, but remember the geography, yeah, it's a good point. The geography of London's very different. Now, one of the things we'll be looking at is the way people assimilate ideas of where they are, what their habitation is, and what that means to them. So Hampton Court is that reference is obviously arch and ironic, but that's what I want you to focus on, the fact that he's being actually quite funny about the way he lives in London. They're kind of, it's a mixture of fantasy and quite kind of disturbing reality that filters through. Okay, what else? What else did you pick up? How did the general tone of the song strike you? Go on, be adventurous. Say a word.
Ironic.
Ironic, funny, yeah. But of course, did you notice what he was called? What was he called? What was the singer called? Lord Kitchener. Now, any bells ringing when I say Lord Kitchener? Very good. So you remember that big poster, Your Country Needs You? So what you have here is a guy from the West Indies adopting the name of an iconic British, really British imperial figure, and singing about belonging to London. London is the place for me. Now, obviously, the tone is, as someone just said, ironic and funny, but there's also real sincerity coming through. He really wants to make a statement about belonging to London. Okay, so that song kind of sets up the issues we're going to engage over the next, well, today and the next 3 weeks. Ideas of belonging and habitation. We all kind of have fairly firm ideas. We tend to have firm ideas about where we come from, for instance. The idea of home is very precious to us. So the idea of belonging, who we are, is pretty much central to our mental makeup. On the other hand, of course, as you saw Lord Kitchener singing, belonging is a complicated thing. Here's a guy, for instance, as I just said, from the Caribbeans, singing about belonging to a space, to a kind of home that is not evidently, he's just arrived, is not evidently his. So he's making a statement about why he belongs to this place. So one of the things we'll look at over the next three weeks and today is how these ideas of belonging, where we come from, who we are, how they constellate, how they form in our heads, and I'm suggesting they form via our engagement with various cultural forms that surround us and that we interact with. Song and music being one of them, but of course literature being other, which is where Sam Selvan's The Lonely Londoners come in. So that's the first kind of point, the first kind of hook on which we hang, which will hang our conversation, idea of belonging and the other ideas of home and so on. The second hook is already kind of implicit in that. How do we arrive at these ideas? As I just said, via our interaction with cultural media of various kinds, especially literary media. But of course, the idea of home itself is not just a metaphoric one. The third hook will hang our conversation on is this idea of what constitutes these very kind of accepted, generally sort of commonsensical ideas of home and exile, home or away. So what are one of the questions we'll be asking is, what are the material coordinates of belonging, where we do and where we don't, and how they transfer themselves onto literary or cultural forms? In other words, when we talk about home, we're not just talking metaphorically, we're talking about a particular kind of space that has a particular history and a particular kind of material coordination. Now, how do we represent that? When I talk about home, I'm talking allegorically, metaphorically, but also physically and materially. So how do we transmit the material or historical idea of home, wherever that may be, not necessarily in London, into cultural forms, when we write about it, when we sing about it, when we think about it, etc.? So that transference, in other words, if you want to talk conceptually, the three kind of key terms for us over this unit will be history, So histories of belonging, histories of exile, histories of movement. We'll be talking about environment in the broadest sense of the term, not just people running around hugging trees, but environment as a kind of material space that encloses us wherever we are, and the relationship between the two, and the third term being literature. So what is the relationship between literature, environment, and history? That's the kind of broad area we're going to cover. Now, when I say history and environment, and the relation with the literary, what would you say springs to? When I say the relationship between history and literature, what would you say is the most obvious thought that springs to mind? How is history present in, let us say, a novel you've read or a song you've heard? Is it a background? Does it do something more? What's the relationship between history and literature, commonsensically, as we take it for granted when we read? Let's see some hands. Sorry? Context, very good. Now, when we say context, there's a sense of history being the kind of platform, let's say, on which the story is enacted, right? That it kind of frames it. And that's a perfectly acceptable way of thinking about history and literature. What I'm going to suggest is context is it's a little bit more, the idea of history and literature, what I'm suggesting, is a more intertwined phenomenon than we usually commonsensically think of it, right? So when I say environment, what springs to mind? Environment and literature. So history is the context of the story that you're reading. What does environment do in literature? Let's see some hands again. Okay, there are two. I'll go here first.
The social setting and the place.
Okay, so social. Why would you say that's not history? Because we've already heard history being the context of social setting. You would say that's history as well. Okay, park that thought. You would say that's history as well. Okay, very good. You see another hand here about environment? Yeah. Physical setting of the place. Now, if you marry the two things that you've just said, what you have is a very sophisticated idea of... Very good, of what environment is, right? The idea of history and physicality interpenetrating each other, right? So when we talk about environment, what we're always talking about is a continuity between what we normally call geography, physicality, and history, chronology or time, together. Now, what I'm suggesting is, how do we look at that via literature? What is the relationship? Is it just the context of what we write? Is it a part of the story of what we, the kind of stories that we tell? How does it become this kind of interpenetrated matrix whereby the three cannot be understood without each other? Now that, in a way, what we're going to look at is what we're going to look at over this unit, and we start that by looking at a particular novel that elicits a particular environment of London at a particular historical point in the mid-50s, and thereby lays out or illustrates this relationship between the three categories of literature, history, and environment. So, the first bit on your handout, the first two quotes on your handout, are not from Selwyn. They're from a guy called Charles Dickens. You'll be familiar, some of you will be familiar with Charles Dickens. And there's the second one is by a guy called T.S. Eliot. So, familiar with Charles Dickens and Eliot? Are there any spares and handouts? Are there any spares and handouts? They're stuck there. It'll come back to you. So, the reason why I cite Dickens and Eliot to start a lecture on Selwyn is to give you an idea of how writing becomes a way of negotiating both an idea of where you are and where you come from. So the first kind of key issue that Sam Selwyn, a West Indian novelist, deals with, being a literary practitioner, when he comes to England, is this idea of his sense of belonging to the English literary space. He's writing in English, he's in West Indian, but he's writing in England, about England. Now, How does he carve out a niche, a space for himself that legitimizes in some ways, that enables him to make this literary move? It's a physical move, of course. He's come all the way from the West Indies to Britain. But he's writing in English, and he wants to make a mark in English literature. So his first preeminent move is a literary move that illustrates this complicated, is an analog to this complicated journey he's made from Trinidad to London. He's making a claim for a new kind of belonging, a new kind of Englishness, in the same way Lord Kitchener is via his music. He's singing in English, he's singing in a style that's distinctively Caribbean, but it's changing the face, even as he's doing so, it's changing the face of English popular music as we know it. Similarly, Selvin is making a literary move, a literary claim, to forging a new kind of sense of belonging and identity that's part Caribbean, but also it's part English. Now, if you see the opening paragraph of the novel, which is the third quote on your handout, and I'll go back to the first quote via this. So, one grim winter evening, when it had a kind of unrealness about London, with the fog sleeping restlessly over the city, and so on. Now, even with those two lines, Selvin has echoed two iconic literary moments of representation of literary London. One is Dickens's famous opening of The Fog, as you see in the first quotation, fog everywhere, fog up the river, etc., where it flows among the green eights, etc. Then that is from the opening of Bleak House. And the next is T.S. Eliot's famous declaration in The Wasteland, unreal city. So taking the imagery of fog and taking the imagery of unreality, what Selvin has done is quite a clever thing here. He's clumped these two things together in the first two lines of his novel and then has made this very funny but very original move. So if you look at the tonal differences between the first two quotations and your third quotation, which is from Selvin. So Selvin, too, talks about grimness. He too, talks about the unrealness of London, deliberately echoing Eliot there. Then he echoes the fog sleeping restlessly, deliberately bringing up Dickens there. And then note what he does. And the lights showing in the blur, as if not London at all, but some strange place on another planet. Moses Alouette hop on number 46 bus at the corner of Chepstow Road and Westbourne Grove to go to Waterloo to meet a fellow who is coming from Trinidad on the boat train. It's a linguistic move that distinguishes himself stylistically from Eliot and Dickens. It's a tonal move that distinguishes himself from Eliot and Dickens. There's that mixture of comic, ironic, but also heartfelt tones that's coming through here that's not quite there in Dickens and Eliot. So what he's taken are iconic moments of literary Englishness. By this time, Dickens and Eliot are a part, accepted part of what we might call the kind of normative or dominant representation of Englishness of a certain kind. He's taken that and he's twisted it around. He's injected a fresh tone, a new perspective, and moreover, a very, very different language, and has married these two elements together. So what you have here, in a way, what Selvin's doing here is making a new claim that legitimizes his presence physically in London, but also within the British literary space itself, but not merely by copying what has gone on before. He's turned it around and, if you like, punched the Caribbean elements with the elements of more settled ideas of Britishness and has come up with a new idiom, much like Lord Kitchener's music, a new idiom of belonging in London at a particular point in history. So, this is obviously the linguistic proliferation and richness of Selvin's own writing and British Caribbean writing in general is obviously one of the first things you notice when you read the novels and the poems and so on. I've given you a snippet of what the critics think about this. So Kenneth Ramchand, for example, talks about the conversion of orality into literariness. What Selvin does is to pick up the oral flavors of Trinidadian street language and turns it into a literary artifice. So what you have here is a marriage of orality, so spoken language, spoken culture, a marriage between that and more established literary codes. So the conversion of orality into literariness becomes a pronounced characteristic of West Indian writing after Selvan, and this manifests itself not only in the shape of language, but also in form and structure, the very form of the novel itself. Those of you finished reading Lonely Londoners will have noticed how formally it strikes us as being original and fresh. For example, that whole monologue about London summer. None of the characters are actually speaking, but we're not quite sure who is saying this. Inserted in the middle of what appears to be a kind of straightforward linear narrative about lives of West Indians, West Indian Caribbean migrants in London, suddenly throws us. What are we reading? So it's not just the language that's been innovated. It's also the form and the content of the novel itself. And in the relationship between the reader and the text, the narrating voice and the narrating stance are those of a Calypsonian, like Kitchener, and the relationship between a Calypsonian and his audience. Similarly, Carol Phillips says, if I were to point to a writer who captures the tone, the texture of London when the austere 50s were about to give way to the swinging 60s, it would have to be the works of Sam Selvan, which would figure preeminently. He did not only know the Caribbean, but the pages of London's A to Z, and was able to capture these with a haunting lyricism. So what you have here, in effect, is a declaration of a new kind of belonging. Here are people who have crossed the seas and who have arrived at the heart of the British metropolis in the 50s, and immediately and astonishingly have been able to forge a new sense of belonging, both in terms of the literature, the literary inheritance, in the case of Selvan and Naipaul and Lemming, but also in the case of the daily lived lives. And there's no way of telling these two moves apart. How people settle in and how people forge a new sense of belonging that enables them to sing about London is the place for me within a year of arriving in London, that what you might call kind of artistic courage, but also a moral and ethical courage of saying, this is my home, that is forged via the medium of literature and culture, and there it takes the place, there it takes the form of a declaration of a newness, a different kind of modernity, where Calypsonian rhetoric, or the West Indian oral culture, it becomes a part. It's no longer on the margins of the cultural field, if you like. It becomes a part of the novelistic representation of London in the new British novels of the 1950s. So what is happening here is a forging of a new kind of Englishness or a new kind of Britishness with the arrival and the settling of new immigrants, but also the forging of a new kind of British literary tradition, a new form of British cultural history that enables people to declare their sense of belonging to a particular kind of space. Okay, so that's the first point I want you to keep in mind. When Lord Kitchener says, London is the place for me, when Sam Selvan writes, One Grim Winter Evening, look at that action that Moses does. He hops on a number 46 bus, goes to Chepstow Road, etc. He's already wearily familiar with the routine of London. He already has a sense of belonging. That takes an act of both aesthetic, but also moral, ethical, and physical courage. And that really is what Selvan's novel in part is about. So a new sense of belonging conducted via a new kind of literature and a new kind of cultural move. That's the first thing to keep in mind. Remember, try and think always the three key things we've talked about: literature, history, environment. There's a particular history that we'll go into in a bit in Selvan's arrival. He has transmuted that into a literary form, and the literary form itself has become a kind of space where these narratives, these figures, these characters live in, And that kind of habitation speaks to the kind of new kind of belongings and habitation that's going on in mid-1950s Britain after the arrival of the Caribbean immigrants throughout the 40s. And this lasts till the moment in the 60s. We'll go into that in a bit. So think of that historical moment between, say, 1948 and early 1960s, when the whole map of London, certainly, but also England, changes. And this really is a documentation of that change. I mentioned the word a new kind of modernity. Of course, one of the central things about modernity is this idea of movement. If you think of Selwyn himself hopping on a boat from Trinidad and arriving in London, that's a pretty big physical displacement. But of course, physical displacement is central. The idea of physical movement, the peripatetic existence of a singular individual, is more or less now commonsensically accepted as a feature of what we might call modernity. Okay? The sense of displacement, the sense of part loss, nostalgia for what has gone, what you have lost, but also gain, what you have gained. That becomes a kind of signature element of what we might call the modern experience. So in one way, this new articulation or idiom of belonging, the new literature of belonging, what it declares is a kind of existence and experience of modernity as such, which involves, and this is the key thing, physical displacement, physical movement, a constant sense of being on the move, a kind of existential restlessness, if you like. So, Marshall Berman, I would recommend you read this book if you get a chance, in a book called All That Is Solid Melts Into Air, talks about this movement, this restlessness, being the signature of modernity, what we think of as the modern. So Berman says there's a mode of vital experience, experience of space and time, not the conjunction of these two things, the experience of space and time, of the self and others, of life's possibilities and perils. Again, this sums up in some ways the British Caribbean existence in the 50s, the experience of life's possibilities and perils that is shared by men and women all over the world today. I call this body of experience modernity. To be modern is to find ourselves in an environment that promises us adventure, much like London. When you arrive in the new city, one of the first things you get is a feeling of being lost, but also a feeling of possibilities. So let's do a quick head count of, give me a sense of your recollection of first arrival in a big city you don't know. What? Tell us.
It was London.
And?
And I didn't expect it to be like that. I imagined Jane Eyre.
You imagined Jane Eyre, right. And you got?
And I got Euston Station.
Yeah, you got Euston Station. And the feeling was one of, obviously, loss, but also a newness, right? It's not Jane Eyre anymore. It's Cappuccino and Euston, right. So that's London. Any other cities? Any of you recall arriving in a major new, and that doesn't have to be a city, it could be a village as well, that throws you a bit? Doesn't have to be outside England. It can be arrival at Warwick, for example.
As a city in Greece.
And tell me a little bit about your experience there. Okay, so, and that, of course, is one of the first things you notice in a new city, right? The language throws you. Did you find it sort of slightly scary?
Completely terrifying.
Completely terrifying.
Okay.
Okay, but were you a little bit excited?
Yeah.
Okay, so that it's that mixture of being completely scared, completely terrified, and sense of possibility that Berman is suggesting is pretty much commonsensical to us now, but it's a signature of this phenomenon we're calling modernity. And that's pretty much what Selwyn is writing about here. I've given you excerpts from the two historical documents. The two quotations that follow there are two legal documents, the 1948 United Kingdom Nationality Act that enables people like Selwyn to come to England. I'm not going to go through that, but there, if you see the first two lines, subject to the provisions of this section, every person born within the United Kingdom and the colonies. That's the key phrase there. So you have a gesture towards the universal there. Every person born within the United Kingdom and all her colonies at that point are entitled to come to Britain. That's the 1948 United Kingdom Nationality Act. And there is a sense a fading sense historically, but still a sense nonetheless, that the universal reach of British Empire entitles a universal sense of British subjectivity, that you're a subject of Britain and you have a right to come to Britain if you're born anywhere in the United Kingdom and the colonies. Notice how quickly that changes. We're talking about 1962 in the next quotation. An act, and that's another legal act, both of these are parliamentary acts, an act to make temporary provision for controlling the immigration into the United Kingdom of Commonwealth citizens, etc., etc. So within a space of, 14 years, you've gone from a universal declaration of British subjecthood to quite a panicky curtailing of who can be called British. So no longer it's saying the citizens of the Commonwealth are entitled to call themselves British, and there's a whole, I mean, obviously, I haven't reproduced the whole act for you. So you're talking about a 14-year period here where the whole idea of Britishness is up for grabs. In 1948, you're British if you're born in Sri Lanka or Trinidad or India or whatever it is. Although not by 48, 47, India's gained independence. Not India, scratch that. But by 62, you're no longer entitled to call yourself as such. Now, the legal kind of implications of that aside, what you're talking about here is about a sense of British subjectivity being in flux. Who is British, who can be English, is very unsettled at this point in time, legally, but also culturally and historically. Thus, Sam Selwyn's statement, which is the following quotation, this island, he's talking about Trinidad here, and he's talking, he makes this, he ruminates about this when he's in Britain and later in Canada, this island is my shadow, and I carry it wherever you go. Wherever I go. So this idea of the island being your shadow, Trinidad being a shadow he carries wherever he goes, this speaks of a certain restless, fractured identity, right? I'm in Canada, I'm in Britain, but I'm carrying Trinidad as a shadow with me. So this speaks of a sense of belonging that is plural. Just like the sense of Britishness, just like the sense of Englishness, who is English, Selwyn's statement points out that seldom will our identities, our idea of who we are, will be settled or monodimensional, one-dimensional. Usually, what we are talking about is a peripatetic sense of who we are ourselves. And that speaks to a certain kind of historical period and a historical experience that Berman calls modernity. So quite often you get this idea of the modern corresponding to a kind of civilizational hierarchy. So X country or X society is more modern and developed than society X or society Y. What Selwyn and Berman between them are asking us to reconsider is the idea of modernity being a universal phenomenon where men and women, as Berman says, across the world define themselves via the idea of movement, via the idea of restlessness. And that becomes, in Selwyn's condition, in Selwyn's case, and in the condition of the modern migrants we see everywhere, all of us mostly, We usually have moved away from our homes, whether we've come to the university, whether you've gone to the new city to find work, whether we're traveling, whether we've emigrated, movement characterizes our modernity, and that obtains in the case of a West Indian coming to Britain or the other way around. So what we're rejecting here is a hierarchy of this concept of the modern. What we're seeing here is a Caribbean modernity nestled within the idea of modern Britain. So Selvan being as subject to a peripatetic condition just as like the rest of us, which is then folded into the long historical duration that we call modernity that embraces the whole world. So we have the idea of a single modernity, but differentiated across time and space, and a relationship and a constant kind of remolding of relationships between the agents, the people who move around. What you have here in the novel and in Selvan's own life is this idea of the island being my shadow. I carry it wherever I go. And this is fed through in the novel. The subsequent quotes you have under that section are from the novel itself. Under the kif-kaf laughter behind the ballad and the episode, the what happening, the summer is hard, he could see a great aimlessness, a great restlessness. And this is a central feature of all the characters in Selvan's fiction. A great aimlessness, a great restlessness. Swaying movement that leaving you standing in the same spot. That paradox between moving but not moving. Moving, standing in the same spot. As if a forlorn shadow of doom fall on all the spades in the country. That shadow of doom, that sense of restlessness, this is the kind of flip side of the joyous calypso that you just heard. The idea of forever carrying yourself within yourself a shadow of loss. This too is a feature of movement, modernity, displacements. But that also prompts this question, which is the other side of this kind of feeling of doom that accompanies you. What it is a city have, that any place in the world have, that you get so much to like it, you wouldn't leave it for anywhere else. This is Selvan's character's musing about the fact that what makes you stay? You can understand what makes you go, and you can understand what makes you arrive. Perhaps you've left to make money, perhaps you left to go to, as I say, go to university for new experiences, go to Greece to see, get the sunlight and the weird new alphabet that surrounds you everywhere. Whatever the reason is, you have an idea of why you want to go. But what makes you stay? What makes you inhabit a space that you're unfamiliar with hitherto? And that obtains as much for you guys arriving in the university as it is for Selvan arriving in London. What is this environment that makes you stay? Okay, so in the case of university is a little bit different. You've paid for it and you're kind of, your parents will probably skin you alive if you go back home. But, so there's a kind of compulsion. But what is it that holds you here? And that is, in a sense, that is what the novel tries to interrogate. What happens when you arrive and stay on? Not just travel through, but stay on. What you have is this doom, this sense of loss, that is one side of that experience, but also that sense of joyous statement, London is the place for me. So what the novel excavates via the varied experiences of the characters is the formation of this sense of ownership where previously there was none. The formation via which sensibilities have the courage to speak up and say, yes, I belong to this place and this place belongs to me. That formation is what the novel is charting. In Selvan's early London fiction, migrant characters' movements throughout the city and the various use of its place names and public sites played a part in the creation of the new immigrant London. The migrant characters' everyday lives, the trajectories of their walks, their gathering in small rented rooms, their manipulation of proper, that is proper spoken English, are political acts. And political acts not in the sense of party political acts, but political acts in the sense of the polity. This is a sense of communal belonging. You make the language yours, not by copying, but by innovating, and but by sort of making the language itself more dynamic through your contributions. You walk the streets, right? One of the things I always do when I go to a new city is get lost deliberately. You walk the street, okay? And you get a sense of your familiar moorings disappearing, but you get a sense of a new kind of belonging that, however temporary, if you're visiting the city, a new kind of belonging that is forged by the very everyday banal action of walking, of familiarizing yourself with the new place names, of perhaps even designating new names for unnamed corners. All these banal everyday acts. I mean, the morning you get up and, you know, go to get a bottle of milk. That is an act of belonging when you come to a new place. So what you see, what you'll see in Selva's, I spoke of migrants, or one of the conditions of modernity being one of migrancy and a sense of loss. But the flip side, we should never forget what the other side of this. It's also a sense of creation of a new kind of belonging via everyday physical actions. So when, who is this? Rebecca Dyer calls the everyday action of walking, gathering in small rented rooms, all those little acts that Selvan's fiction charts so lovingly, they become a new declaration, a new statement of a new kind of identity. Okay, so migration is not all about loss and this melancholy of having left my island behind, but it's also this queering, this new sense of what makes me stay. And what makes you stay is not so much the kind of glitz and glamour of the new city, but what you do physically in your everyday lives, with your language, with your relationship with other people, with the new names of the places that you're familiarizing yourself with. So that is relevant for all of us, but Selvan's fiction, because it charts a particularly dramatic moment in that forging of new senses of belonging, it opens our eyes to this movement, migrancy, being a signal condition of the modern that affects all of us. And that, as I say, has both its sides. So the final thing that, or the final set of issues that we'll raise to then stop and take up next week is what are the signal categories of, so you've come to a big city, you've walked, you've struggled, you've made it your own in some ways. How does that affect, going back to that original question I raised in the beginning of the lecture, how does that affect the sense of who we are? Now, all of us are handed down, we have these kind of commonsensical categories of race, gender, and class, more kind of sort of contestably in our heads, right? We have an idea of, you know, what gender we belong to, what race we belong to, what class we belong to, etc. Now, how does the condition of movement and modernity, if indeed it applies to all of us, as it does to Selvan, how does it modulate these senses of belongings, these senses of identities? That is something that Selvan's novel is interested in charting as well. So there's a moment in the novel when Sir Galahad is walking the London street, and he gets this. "Mummy, look at that black man, a little child holding onto the mother's hand. Look up to Sir Galahad." "You mustn't say that, dear," the mother chided the child. "What a sweet child," Galahad said, putting on the old English accent. "What's your name?" Think about that exchange here in comparison to a similar incident recorded in another iconic work of critical thinking that comes out a little later, Frantz Fanon's Black Skins, White Masks. This is Fanon walking in Paris. "Look, mum, a Negro." This is Fanon walking, and a French child similarly, just like the English child, exclaims, "Look, mum, a Negro." But what I'm interested here is the difference between the reaction of Selvan and Fanon. So here's Fanon's reaction. "I came into the world imbued with the will to find a meaning in things, my spirit filled with the desire to attain to the source of the world, and then I found that I was the object in the midst of other objects, sealed into that crushing objecthood." This child who says, "Look, mama, Negro," suddenly it's like a guillotine that comes between me, i.e. Fanon, and the sense of my sense of belonging to the world. Suddenly I am no longer the subject looking at the world in wonder. Suddenly I am being looked at. And this triggers off this whole interrogation in Fanon about the sense of race and belonging. Now, that is important, but contrast that to what Sir Galahad does. What a sweet child, Galahad say. And the next phrase is interesting. Putting on the old English accent. This is not someone who suddenly says, I'm being crushed into this objecthood and I'm being objectified as a black man. This is someone who reacts immediately with an innovative move. He puts on, he performs an old English accent, not his. And then he says, what's your name? What a sweet child, what's your name? So instead of, I'm not trying to suggest that Fanon is wrong and Sir Galahad is right here. What I'm suggesting here there is that what happens via your identity of who you are racially is a mobile category depending on your performance and the performance of the collectivity around you. When this child says, look, mum, a black man, Sir Galahad immediately performs accentually, puts on an old English accent and pets the child. He says, what a sweet child you are. Okay, you're just being a bit racist and just call me black man, but you're a sweet child, right? So that he immediately counters that with a sense of humor and a sense of owning the language that he's speaking. He switches the English around and puts on a really plumb English accent. So what you have here, Fanon's reaction of being objectified is one common and legitimate response, of course, to the idea of race. But so is Sir Galahad's and Selvon's. So what you have here is an idea of race being a discriminatory category, but also something that you modulate and you perform and you counter, you kind of fight against that discrimination via the tools you have, a kind of comic response, a kind of put-on accent. So what you have here is not so much a militant rejection, neither, I think, a kind of acquiescence to the category of race, but a kind of playing with it, a playfulness. And one of the things that Selvon's novel does is to accentuate, that's why he's so into Calypso, the idea of playfulness, playing with language, playing with identity, playing with a sense of who you are. It's not an easy thing to do. I'm not suggesting it's also something you do casually as you laugh along. But it's a real, the previous sort of quotation said politics, it's a political gesture. Again, not in a party political sense, but in the sense that you are using the cultural tools available to you to counter the kind of hardened, discriminatory, categorizing ideas of what race is. So it's you approach it with the idea of playfulness, of movement, really. There's no settled idea here. You're performing as you're going. So one of the ways in which movement, modernity, migrancy impacts on our idea of who we are is to throw those settled ideas of race and hierarchy and the other categories that could be discriminatory and divisive. One of the ways it shakes it up is via this language of movement, this humor, this music, this sense. In other words, without the movement, the challenge to these settled categories are harder to make. So migrancy becomes a really difficult experience, a really challenging experience, but in some ways an enabling one. I'll be careful not to celebrate a kind of migrancy as, you know, is a kind of in a banana republic way, all you know, everything's fine, we move around everywhere equally. That's clearly not the case. Migrancy is a very, very difficult experience, and it differentiates along class and gender axes. It differs on it depends on who you are, where you're coming from, what is your capital, cultural, and otherwise. But it does have an enabling aspect to it that Selvon is interesting in capturing. That's why Galahad doesn't quite react like Fanon does. He reacts, he kind of snatches away some of the discriminatory powers of that statement, look, mummy, a black man, and turns it into a comic mode, which is essentially what Calypso does as well. So 5 minutes and two more categories. Race is one category that is, if you like, mashed up. by the movement, by the phenomenon of migrancy. It's thrown, it's unsettled. Okay? Gender is obviously another, and along with gender goes the idea of sexuality that is central to Selvan's novel. Let's pick on a moment that Tanti, that wonderful Trinidadian character, is grumbling, right? White girls, Tanti grumble as she put the kettle on the fireplace fire. Is that what sweetened up so many of you to come to London? Your own kind of girls, not good enough now, is only white girls. Now, Selvan's novel is quite often criticized for buying into this image of hyper-masculine black men. So some critics, for example, or some observers have accused Selvan of pandering to the stereotype of a sexualized image of black men that actually, or non-white men, threatening, as Tanti says, the white girls. The interesting thing is, here's Tanti says it, but I'll come back to that. And playing up to that image, which was being used in the 50s and 60s, and of course subsequently as a really damaging racist device by people alarmed by migration. Right. So. As Marcus Collins notes, this is on your handout, Negrophiles and Negrophobes, white writers appear to be obsessed by the sexual relationships between black men and white women. As with previous sexual perils occurring in Britain and its colonies, yellow, brown, black, etc., West Indian men were widely regarded by white observers to be predatory creatures who, quote, kept their hunting instincts alive by stalking prey in human form and female gender. Now, this is being used, remember, outside the National Front marches, in the tabloid press, in the and not just the tabloid press, in the kind of so-called broadsheets as well, as a sense of national crisis around the time Selvan's writing. What is interesting here is that he doesn't dodge the issue, and to my mind, he doesn't really give in to the stereotype, I don't think he's stereotyping black men and sexuality and the relationship between black men and white women here. He's not dodging the issue, but he's also showing the formation of how that sensibility comes into being. Now, clearly, there are characters in the novel who subscribe to this particular gender stereotype, who talk up their own masculinity. If you look at Selvan's description of the dialogue and the between the kind of, in his word, sharp spades who congregate in the dance halls, etc., a lot of time they're talking women, music, and sex. But a lot of what Selvan is also doing is to show how they come with a certain kind of gender stereotype about masculinity, what men are supposed to do and supposed to perform and supposed to talk about in relation to their sexuality, already from the Caribbean societies, that receives a further kind of inflection from the environment within which they have arrived. So quite often you'll see these men talking themselves up, but talking their own sexual prowess up, for example. But they're doing so in the context of this already formed stereotype about what they should do and how they should behave. Admittedly, that stereotype obtains as much in the Caribbean as it does in London, but that is not something that, if you like, arises naturally from them. This is a kind of prescribed role. This is a kind of normative role culturally they've been familiarized with. So they talk the talk, but quite often, you'll notice in Selvan's novel, after talking the talk, they slip into the kind of a kind of melancholia about it. They kind of go, okay, actually, you know, we have talked about all these women and dance hall. Actually, we are not that good. You know, actually, we are not that hard. Actually, it's kind of, a lot of it is frontage. It's a lot of it is performance. The interesting thing for Selvan is he's interested in showing this up as a performance. In other words, the men are burdened, as well as, you know, playing up to it, they're burdened with a sense of how they should act. and they try and act accordingly, quite often failing to do so, and then slipping into this kind of melancholic reflection of whether they're really men or not, or hard enough men or not about it. So what Selvin is doing here is not so much showing the stereotype of black masculinity, but trying to chart how that masculinity is produced and what effect that migrancy has on that. What effect movement has on that? What effect displacement has on that? So that's what the novel is trying to chart, and not so much kind of subscribe to the stereotypes that it's writing about. So I think I'm going to stop here. I'm going to take up the signal issue of the relationship between class and subject formation when we talk about Williams next week. Are we talking about Williams next week? We are, yes. We talk about Williams next week. Hold on to the idea of Selvin's novel, because we're going to thread that through in all the 3 weeks that's coming up. So when you talk about Williams next week, we're going to revisit the novel.